Okay, we're in the book of Isaiah, working our way through. And we started the second half of Isaiah with chapter 40 a couple weeks ago as we talked about God. Isaiah has been talking about God, telling us who God is, the sides of God that we don't always think about, the extensive, powerful creator, and then this gentle shepherd tied together in one. And so we're trying to learn about God. Last week we had a lot of things about God to think about. Now we come to chapter 45, a little bit of 44, 45, and 46. And this is really fascinating. Fascinating things really capture your attention. It's for purpose of it is to engage our minds. Remember, he's been talking about who is God, and now he's gonna do something that only God can do, so he can show us what it is. Now, a couple years ago, I can't remember when. All I know is we did it. I did a whole section on historical prophecy. And some of the fascinating parts of the Bible are those parts which there was prophecy, and then the fulfillment we can see in history. So we can look back and say, here's what God said was going to happen, and there's what happened. And there are historical events in the history of the world that were prophesied in the Bible. And it is not like somebody predicting the weather. That's not what it's about, all right? They can say anything. You're going to predict the weather. Is President Trump going to win next time? You can predict it. Go ahead. Take a guess. Predict it. You can predict things, and you say, well, I think that might happen. That is not what this is about. This is going to tell us what is going to happen, and then it exactly unfolds in that way. And who of us knows the future? Nobody. We don't know tomorrow. We're not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. You think you know. I think I know what I'm going to do, but we don't really know anything about the future. God has kept that from us, but occasionally he stepped out and told what the future is going to bring. So we have three sections in the Bible as far as prophecy: historical prophecy, events that occurred in history, and then we can look back and show how close they came true. And then there's the prophecy of Christ. Over 100 different prophecies about Jesus coming into the world. And those are also amazingly accurate. And then we have another set of prophecy, things that haven't happened yet. All right, so if the first prophecy about the history of the world is exactly and precisely right, and then the next prophecy about the Christ, coming of Christ, is exactly right, what's our conclusion? Prophecy about our future is also exactly right. Okay? So these are faith-building passages. When I grew up, nobody ever talked about these. They just ignored it. I found them kind of on my own and started studying them, and there are people out there that did it. And so it's fascinating to realize how precisely reliable the Bible is. And that's what we're about to look at tonight. However, this passage, if we're going to look at it right, now what I always did with this passage when I talked about it in the past was we pulled it out as a historical prophecy. So this is prophecy, and we pull out the historical side of it. That's not essentially why it's written, although it is written to inform. It's more than that. It's to show you the kind of God that we have who can look into the future, tell us what's going to happen. And if you're going to exercise your mind tonight, you got to come up with some conclusion. I'm going to force you to that as we get come. I'm fine, yeah. As we get along, I'm going to force you to make a conclusion. And that's where we're headed. Okay, now we're going to start with Isaiah 44. This is really about God. It's about the capability of God to know things and inform us. And so, first, of course, he talks about God. Isaiah 44, 24. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, he that formed thee from the womb. I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars, that be humans, and maketh diviners mad, or people who say they know the future, that turneth wise men backwards and maketh their knowledge foolish, that confirmeth the word of his servant, performeth the counsel of his messengers. My soul, he says, my knowledge is superior. Human knowledge gets turned aside and made to look foolish. And so I'm going to tell you something that's going to happen here. That saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, to the cities of Judah you shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof. And so he says here, Jerusalem will be inhabited. It's going to be actually rebuilt. All right, now Isaiah's saying that in his lifetime. And you say, well, why would you say that? Jerusalem's saying it right there. Because it's not always going to be right there. It's going to get smashed into tiny little pieces. That is in the future for Isaiah. All right, it's in the future for Isaiah. They're going to smash Jerusalem. And when I say smash it, I mean smash it. Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem four times. First three times he chose out prime people, took them as his captives to serve him. Whatever way he seemed fit, he took the cream of the crop. Each time the best he could find. The last time he just killed most of them. And he left the place in utter ruin. Utter ruin. Nothing left. It says, not one stone standing on another. And so he also wiped out the cities all around. And so that in the land of Israel, what was cities and what was towns, villages are empty. Everybody's gone. They're either killed, mostly killed, or taken captive, hauled off to Babylon. So, that's going to come. He's not talking about that. He's talking about after that devastation is over, it's going to be rebuilt. That's what he wants to talk about. Here we go. Verse 27. That saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. Now, we're going to make a few notes here so that we can follow along. I'm going to say, dry up. He says, I'm going to dry up the rivers. All right? We'll come back, tie these together. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. All right? So he now mentions a person, Cyrus. We can add to it Cyrus the Persian to identify him in history. God says, I'm going to have Cyrus rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the foundation of the temple. Now, We have that done in the book of Nehemiah. All right. Nehemiah rebuilds the wall. Ezra comes first, and he lays the foundation for a new temple. Nebuchadnezzar wiped the whole place out. And so they lay a foundation. If you recall the story, they lay the foundation, going to build a new temple, going to start over. And the old men cried like babies because it wasn't nearly as big and fancy as it used to be. And so we had Haggai and Zechariah, two prophets at that time, said, "You may not think much of this little temple, you old fellas. Remember the fancy one that used to be here. But let me tell you something. The Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to this temple. This temple is going to be the one that God comes into." And we know that Jesus went in the temple on various occasions. And so that, he says, is going to be a great thing. So this is what's coming in the future. Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt, inhabited, the temple itself. And it's going to be done by a fellow by the name of Cyrus the Persian. "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut." All right, so mentions again Cyrus the Persian. He said, "We're going to loose the loins of kings." A few phrases that they use: gird up your loins. That means you tighten up your clothes, put a belt on, basically tighten up your clothes so you can get going. Let's go. Gird up your loins. Let's go. All right. If you loose your loins, you're fading away. All right. You're not getting ready to go. You've just been stopped, faded away. So he says, we're going to loose the loins of kings, and we are going to open two leaf gates. We're going to open two leaf gates. I'm going to have that for you to do first two. "I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, cut asunder the bars of iron." There are brass gates. They're going to be destroyed. Let's go on. 3, "I will give to thee the treasures of darkness, the hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel." And he will have treasures, hidden treasures. Okay. See what else he's got here. 4, "For Jacob my servant's sake and Israel mine elect, I have seen even call thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, there is none else, there is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me." All right, so he says, "I gave you power. I girded you. I gave you power. And Cyrus, you serve me." He calls him the anointed. Who else had that name? Right, Christ, the name Christ, the word Christ means the anointed one. And ultimately, Christ is the ultimately anointed one. However, anointing is the ability to do something special. That's what we call anointing. So God gives somebody a particular ability and he anoints them with an ability to do something special. Cyrus was anointed. It says in verse 1, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holding. So he says, I got a hold of you. I'm giving you power to do all kinds of things. And you don't know who I am. I love that. It's just fantastic. That's God. He says, you don't know me, but you are going to be used by me. You say, how or why would God use somebody that doesn't even know him? Well, he can do that over and over and over and over again. And when I started here, I had a fascinating little thing happen. There was a group of us that were beginning to work here, and we just clean for several weeks. All we do is clean, because it was pretty rough. And this guy walked in, and he said, show me what you're doing. So I took him around the building. He says, how much you get paid to work here? I said, I pay you the same thing I get. He said, nothing, huh? I said, yep, nothing. And he said, I'll be here. He didn't know the Lord. He just got freed from prison. And there was a young lady who happened to come over here. I think he was quite interested in. And so he came here. Maybe because she was here, but that's not the real reason he came. God was going to use him. Didn't matter that he didn't know God or really even want to know God. God was going to use him. So God used him. He was a foreman on a construction crew. He could do about anything. He came in and see, you need a bulldozer here. You understand that there was trees and bushes in the what is now a yard. Didn't look like this at all. He said, we need a bulldozer. Next week, he brought a bulldozer. He said, how are you going to work on that ceiling up there? I said, well, I'm not sure. Got to get a couple ladders together. Ah, never mind. Next week, he brought scaffolding. He said, what are you going to do upstairs? Well, we got to try to make a frame. I'll do it. He made a framework. He did all kinds of things. He brought all kinds of equipment, stuff that we had no access to, and he brought it and brought it. He was crazier than a bed bug on the steeple, been struck by lightning. And there were melted places where the shingles melted. He said, I can fix him. How many ladders you got? I said, well, we got three. And I said, but they're not extension ladders. That don't matter. He climbed up the first ladder, tied the second one to it, climbed up the second one, tied the third one to that, went to the top of the third ladder, put his leg over the top, and repaired the shingle. I said, man, this guy's crazy. He didn't know God. And he never, as far as I know, came to know God. He just disappeared when all the work was done. God said, you need help. I know this guy, and I'm going to have him help you. So don't think that because people don't believe in God, that don't know God, that God's not going to. God does whatever he wants. He can take people that don't know him and use them just the same. Cyrus, he said, you don't know me. You don't know who I am. You don't know me at all, but I know you by name. I know your name. All right, now let's try to put this in a framework to help us to think about this. is used by God. God has the ability to use God, to use people whatever way he wants. Cyrus has, he worships whatever, the gods of the day. All right, now let's see where God talks about that. You're going to see something here very striking. You say, this can't be right. Remember, he's talking about Cyrus. Verse 6. They that know from the rising, that they may know from the rising of the sun from the west, there is none beside me. I am the Lord. There is none else. All right, so from the rising of the sun on the east all the way to the west, or all over the world, I want people to know who I am. I want them to know that I am God. Verse 7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. There. There, you scholars. What is that? How does that one hit you? I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now, Cyrus, being the Persian, all right, and being in the time that he lived in, believed in various gods, one god on one side, one god on the other. There's a god that controls good, and there's a god that controls bad. There's a good god over here somewhere working. We'll worship him, and then there's one that does bad things, and we need to worship him too. And God says to Cyrus, everything that happens, I'm doing it. Well, did God create evil? He created the world. He created the people that are in it. Did he know that they would be evil? Bet your life he did. Because the Bible says before the foundation of the world, before God said, all right, let's make this world, before that, Jesus was slain in the mind of God. So God sat down and said, shall we, God the Father, God the Son, the Spirit, are in holy conclave. Shall we create a world? Yes. Shall we create a race? Yes. Do you know what they'll do? They will revolt. How much? They will revolt to their own absolute destruction. Should we make them? If we make them, we should do something. What should we do? Rescue them from their own foolishness? Yes. So how are we going to do that? We're going to have to die and substitute ourselves so that the punishment that they deserve falls on us. And so the Son of God said, I will go into the world, extend myself into the world, and I will live among humans and I will die. I agree to that. Now let's create the race. So Jesus was slain already in the mind of God before the world was made. And so he knew that there was evil, but he's trying to say to Cyrus, you think there's various little gods here controlling evil. It's all me. It's all me. And if I created a system that I knew would go bad, you can rest assured, I can handle it. I can control it. I am in charge of it. Let them do the worst. Matter of fact, we're going to let the human race get so ultimately evil that comes up one called Antichrist, who will be the ultimate personification of evil, will give himself to the devil. And when the world has got as bad as it could get, then I'll fix it in about 5 minutes. Bam. Battle Armageddon wipes it out. Simple. Easy. Easy for God to do. And so he's telling Cyrus, It's not what you think. It's not a little puppet God pulling strings around here. It's me. I did it all. And I'm controlling you, Cyrus. Verse 8. Drop down, ye heavens from above. Let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the earth open. Let them bring forth salvation. Let righteousness spring up together. I, the Lord, have created it. Right, so he says, it's God. I'm pouring down from heaven righteousness, salvation. I'm going to do good things for the earth. 9. Woe to him that striveth with his maker. Let the potsherds strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him that fashions it, what makest thou, or thy work? He hath no hands. Woe unto him that saith to his father, what begettest thou, or to the woman, what hast thou brought forth? He says the clay can't say to the potter, hey, I don't like this pot you're making. No, clay can't do that. He says humans, they think they can do whatever. They think they can say to their father, who do you think you are bringing me into this world? He said, you're already here. You don't get a choice, right? Like Charlie Brown said, here I am. I didn't even get to fill out an application. There you go. Okay? God says, we don't get to demand things and say things. We don't get to talk back to our parents. Hey, what'd you make me for? That's foolish. Verse 11. Thus saith the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, his maker, ask me of things concerning my sons, concerning the work of my hands, command ye me. I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens and all their hosts. I have commanded, I have raised him up in righteousness. I will direct his ways. He shall build my city. He shall let my captives, not for price nor reward. Lord, saith the Lord of hosts. All right, we add another thing to the list here. He's going to let go captives. He's going to let go captives. So he gave us a list. Cyrus the Persian, my anointed one, dry up rivers, loose the loins of kings, open up Thule's gates, destroy brass gates, hidden treasures, let go captives. He is used by me to do what I want to have done. I'm in charge of the world. I have created it. Now, let's try to make a little spot here. I'm about to ask you that impossible question. Force you to think about it. If we say that this little line here represents, this little line here represents time. Right there, the beginning of time. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and so the clock started ticking. It's time. And we know that time comes to an end. Time, as we know, the passing of time, the aging of people, and the being bound in by space and time will come to an end. Comes to an end. Christ will return to this earth. He will set up a kingdom. He will reign for 1,000 years. And then he will have one more battle and destroy all evil, put everything rebellious out of the way. It's all gone. And then he brings heaven to earth. Two dimensions that have been separated since they've been created. Earth, time-space continuum, we're stuck here, we can't go anywhere. And heaven, a separate dimension of existence, come together. And John says, I saw the new Jerusalem coming out of heaven down to earth. So the dimension of heaven, he says, and God will dwell on the earth, dwell in Jerusalem, no need of the sun, because God is here. That's pretty good. Say, son, we don't need you anymore. We got God here. All right? God's going to be all the light we ever need. It's pretty amazing. But then time ceases. No longer does the clock tick. And so once this dimension of existence folds into an eternal dimension of existence, then time ends. All right? So we have time beginning and time ending. Where are we? Are we here? I don't know exactly where we are. Who knows how much longer it's going to go. But time is, that's it. This is eternity. Not really eternity, because I'd have to use the whole board, and that wouldn't be fair even. I'm just trying to get my point across. So, eternity is over here, right? It's before time. Eternity is already over here. It's after time. God lives in eternity. So, how does he know the future? He's already been there. Has he been in the future already? See, how can that be? Eternity has no limits, no boundaries. So, if God dwells in eternity, he's already on the other side of time. Now, last week, we had a name for God. What was it? The first and the last. The Alpha and the Omega. The beginning and the end. So, let me ask you this question. Is God already in our future? Or does he absolutely control everything that happens? Is he looking at this because he's already in the future and able to tell things that are going to happen in the future? Or does he absolutely control everything that happens? And so, I know what I'm going to do. Which one is it? Does he dwell in eternity? Or does he absolutely control the human events? What'd you say?
Both.
Exactly. Simple answer, both. He's in both. He exists in the future, so he can come along and say, I got Cyrus the Persian. Now, what's the year? Say it's 2020. So let's go back to the year 1890. Let's go back to the year 1890. Somebody in 1890 would come along and say, there's a guy named Donald Trump who's going to be president. You say, that seems really far out. Isaiah, from God's ear, told me, wrote us down, there's a guy named Cyrus coming. How far into the future? 130 years. Was Cyrus born yet? Not on your life. Four generations before Cyrus, when the Persian Empire did not exist, was no Persian Empire. Neither was there a Babylonian Empire just beginning. 130 years before, God said there's a guy named Cyrus coming. So, he said, I know his name. His name is Cyrus. He's going to do things for me. Cyrus the Persian, when he comes, he's doing what I want him to do. How do I know? I control him. I absolutely control whatever he does. and I'm having him do things that I want him to do. Does God know the future? Yes, God knows the future, but he is controlling Cyrus the Persian. He say, but Cyrus doesn't even believe in God. Cyrus believes in this and that and the other thing about God. Doesn't matter. God said, that doesn't matter what he believes. It's what I want done, and I'm going to get this done. And so here it is. I'm going to do this. Cyrus the Persian, 130 years before God says, How does God know? I don't know. I can't explain it. I can show you things like that and ask you questions, but I don't know. Just God knows. So, he says, you are going to rebuild Jerusalem. Well, we didn't know Jerusalem was going to be wrecked. Well, it was wrecked, all right, by Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon. Cyrus the Persian, you're going to serve me. My people were taken captive by Babylon. They're in Babylon now. I want them free. So you're going to let those captives go free. It says, for no ransom, no charge. All right, so Cyrus had a job to do. He's got to take over Babylon in order for that to happen. Well, Babylon is a huge, huge city. And 50 miles along the walls. Walls are 350 feet high in some places. Our steeple is 90. Almost four times higher than our steeple. They said that the walls were so wide they could ride four chariots abreast on top of the walls of Babylon. That's the main wall. There's another wall outside of that, which is a dirt wall, which you can expect they would have to have. And so they got a big, huge dirt wall around that, 350 foot walls. There are, under the wall flows the Euphrates River. The Euphrates River flows and it goes under the wall. And so they can go in there and just lock the gates. There are, let's see. I think there's 25 brass gates on each wall. So there's 100 gates of brass on each wall. Cyrus the Persian, with those kind of fortifications, people would think, how are you going to ever take the place? How are you going to march on a city with 350 feet wall? We would say we would have to wait until the invention of the airplane before you could take a place like Babylon. So, the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, is gone. His grandson is named Belshazzar. Belshazzar. He's the king of Babylon. Cyrus the Persian has swept across the entire east. The Persian Empire goes from Greece to Egypt to India, all conquered by Cyrus. They said it was such a swift conquering that he would come to the city, would fall the next day and go on and go on and go on, just push his way across until the Persian Empire was covered everything. Persian Empire. All right. So this man has a tremendous power to loose the loins of kings. All right. He comes to the city of Babylon to take it. But you can't get in. can't get in. And so he sets his arming out here to dig a ditch. They were laughing at him from inside. They were laughing at him. He's digging a hole in the ground. What's he doing? What's he doing? So he digs a ditch. And you'd say, well, what's his plan? Well, his plan is to take the Euphrates River and dry up the riverbed. I will dry up your rivers, okay? That's the prophecy there. He's going to change the course of the Euphrates River by dumping it into the ditch. And then he wants to go under the wall, because the wall is over top of the Euphrates River. He's going to go on, not try to go over, but to go under it through the Euphrates River. Now, the thing of it is, Nebuchadnezzar, much smarter than that, he put two big, huge gates in the river. And so they could leave the gates open during the day, and people could go in and out of the river. And then right in the water itself, in the river, these two big swinging gates. They close the gates at night and lock the gates. So nobody can do what he's planning to do. And so the day comes. He's ready to change the course of Euphrates River. And the two gates in the river, somebody forgot to lock them. They were open. And so he broke open the ditch, dried up the riverbed, all right, marched through the gates that were left open. The two leave gates under the wall were left open, came in, and without firing a shot, took the greatest kingdom up to that day, the greatest city of that time. He walked in on a little party that was going on, Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes and wives and concubines might drink therein. Okay, so now he's got the vessels from Jerusalem. And Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. He took the gold cups and the silver pitchers and everything he could find and took it back. And now they're using it for a party. Belshazzar is using it for a party. That's the hidden treasures. They were hidden for 70 years in Babylon till Cyrus came in that night. Now he owns the treasures. And verse 5, the same hour came forth, the fingers of a man's hand wrote over against the candlestick on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. The king saw the part of the hand that wrote. You heard of the handwriting on the wall. Belshazzar is watching and the hand writes on the wall. Meeny, meeny, tickle, you fart. You have been weighed. You have been found wanting. All right. Verse 6. The king's countenance was changed. His thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loose and his knees smote one against the other. There you go. He loosed the loins of kings. Belshazzar's knees were knocking together when he looked at the hand on the wall and heard a knock at the door. It was Cyrus. Cyrus came in and took over Babylon. So he's got the hidden treasures from Jerusalem, And what does Cyrus do? The Persians say, let those Jews go back and build the temple. So God got his people out, dried up the rivers, loosed the loins of kings. Two gates were left open. The brass gates all around the city were of no value, destroyed, and the captives are set free 130 years before it happened. So what's your opinion of God? He can handle it, can he? Verse 14 now of Isaiah 45. Thus saith the Lord, the labor of Egypt, merchandise of Ethiopia, and the Sabians, men of stature, shall come over unto thee, they shall be thine. They shall come after thee in chains, they shall come over, they shall fall down unto thee, they shall make supplication unto thee, saying, surely God is in thee, and there is none else, there is no God. Verily thou art a God that hidest thyself, O God of Israel, the Savior. They shall be ashamed and confounded, all of them. They shall go with confusion together that are makers of idols. They're going to be ashamed when they realize I've been worshiping a stick of wood or a piece of gold or some silly thing, when I got a God who can go 130 years into the future and by name the man who's going to destroy the city of Babylon, exactly how it's going to unfold and the purpose of it, let my people go and bring them home. Right, so you're going to be ashamed if you don't worship this God. You ought to be ashamed if you don't worship this God. Look at what he can do. Right, does he know the future? Much more than that. He's controlling it. He's in charge of it. All right. Verse 18. Thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he established it, created it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, there is none else, I have not spoken in secret. In the dark place of the earth, said I not to the seed of Jacob, seek ye me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness, I declare things that are right. So, God didn't speak in the dark. He spoke in the light. God said to Isaiah, write these things down. Go ahead, write that name down. And Isaiah said, who's Cyrus? Just write the name down. Because in East Shelby, 3,000 years later, they're going to read that I knew his name before he was born. Just so you think you and God are on some kind of par, I don't think so. All right. So God, verse 22, the ultimate goal. Look to me, be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God. I'm in charge. I'm the one. I'm going to bring salvation to the world. Of course, he's talking about Jesus. Talking about Jesus. Now, let's go into 46 a little bit. Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Your idols are upon the beast and upon the cattle. Your carriages are heavy laden. They are a burden to the weary beast. Bel was the god, the chief god of the Babylonians. That's why his name is Belshazzar. Anybody know Daniel's Babylonian name? Belteshazzar. Also called by Nebuchadnezzar by the name Bel. That was his favorite god. And so he's got a Bel on one side and Nebo on the other. People believe that Bel represented some prince. All right, and that Nebo represented a prophet. And so whoever was running the system, the false religion that had put Bel in charge. They got a prince somewhere named Bel, and they got a prophet. There will always be a prophet for any false religion. They'll always find prophets. Lots of them in the world. They stoop down, bow together. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves are gone into captivity. What happened to you, Bell? Well, we got you now riding along on a donkey's back. They put you down where you belong. You're nothing but something on a beast of burden. That's all you amount to. Verse 3, hearken to me, O house of Jacob, the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb, and even to your old age I am he, even to hoar hairs will I carry you. I have made, I will bear, I will carry, and will deliver you. All right? God says, I'm in control of you from before you're born till your hair is old and gray. I got you. I got you from before you're born till your hair is old and gray. So if I can do all that, verse 5, whom will you liken me and make me equal? Compare me that we may be like. They lavish gold out of the bag, weigh silver in the balance, hire a goldsmith, he maketh it a god. They fall down, yea, they worship. They bear him on the shoulders, they carry him, set him in his place, and he standeth in his place. And he shall not remove, he can't get up and leave. And one shall cry and yet not answer, and save him out of his trouble. Remember this. Show yourselves men, bring it again to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, there is none else. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. So, I can tell you what happened before into ancient times, and I control your future. There's the God who we serve. All right. Now, are you worried about your future? How's the world going? Do you think the world's going to blow up or something? He's got a hold. He says, I'm controlling it. And I want you to stop being afraid. I want you not to have fear anymore. I'm able to control these things. I am God. I can decide the end from the beginning and the ancient things. And so his purpose of telling us all these things about Cyrus, which are historically accurate, be shown in history, is that he did it 130 years before it happened. All right? And that's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. Verse 11, calling a ravenous bird from the east, man that executed my counsel from a far country, yea, I have spoken it and will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it. So if I serve a God who was able to do that, who was able to show the destruction of kingdoms, the rebuilding of other kingdoms, the rising up of one of the great generals of all time, Cyrus the Persian. All right? If I knew all that long before it ever happened, what I'm planning in your future is true. I've told you what's going to happen. Go to Matthew chapter 24 as Jesus himself describes the future. And you open, of course, Paul's writings all the way through. He's telling us what's going to happen in our future. So are those reliable? They are more than reliable. They are precise and exact and under the complete control of God. Under the complete control of God. You can trust him with the future. You can trust him. All right. Verse 13, I bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off. My salvation shall not tarry. I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. And where was Jesus crucified? In Zion. Jerusalem, the capital city. He said, I'm going to place salvation there. That's what happened. Jesus Christ came, died in Jerusalem, in the city of Zion, God's city. Outside the walls, what? He rose again. So he knew exactly and precisely what would happen. He shows it historically. He mentions the coming of a Savior in Zion, in Jerusalem. Christ came there. Now, are you willing to trust him with the rest? I am. I think I can trust him with whatever's in my future. I'd like to know more about it, but he didn't think I was worth writing about. Cyrus was. He told the story of the king of Persia and 130 years before it happened. That's a long time to look into the future. Of course, he went much farther than that with Christ. Christ's prophecy, the first one, was 4,000 years before it happened. Right? The first prophecy about Christ was 4,000 years before it was accomplished. So the prophecies of Christ are much more amazing than this. I think these are amazing and fascinating, but ones of Christ stretched out for 4,000 years. In the French song, they say, for 4,000 years, we've been waiting for him to come, and now he is born. He's here. So there's God represented as one who knows the future, not just knows it, but controls it. Exactly what he wants to happen. Thank you.